This is Mitchell Dye with Mitchell's Front Page on 94.7 The Pulse.
Simon Ramsay is now joining us on the line. He's the member for Western Victoria Region in the Legislative Council. Simon Ramsay, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Mitch.
Thanks for being with us this morning, especially on this public holiday. First of all, the Western Australian election result was pretty big, and one of the things that stood out for me was that rather than small swings, we saw massive and consistent swings. And this is similar to what we're seeing in states like Queensland, where they seem to change governments regularly. So do you think that has ramifications for Victoria, that votes that were previously rusted on aren't rusted on anymore?
Well, I think sort of an eight-year term of the Bennett government has, you know, indicated the West Australian electorate wanted a change, and no doubt with the One Nation in the mix, it sort of created a spread of votes across the board. But there's no doubt there was a very strong indication that they wanted a change of government, and Labor did very well in WA yesterday.
And One Nation was expected to get a vote in the teens, potentially, but only ended up with about 4.3%. Do you think that that was because there was a preference deal potentially done and One Nation lost that protest vote element, that they could be seen to be some sort of minor and independent party?
Yeah, look, I think people saw One Nation for what it is, and why Pauline Hanson was indicating she was hoping to get three upper house seats with potentially an 8% primary, she fell well short, and I think that's an indication that people saw through a lot of the huff and puff of Pauline Hanson and looked for substance in One Nation's policies, couldn't find it, and voted accordingly. And I think we need to be very wary, given the backlash from the electorate in relation to preference deals with One Nation, that we don't follow suit in Victoria.
Because that could have been the X factor going into the election, given that the vote for Colin Barnett was likely to fall, especially given that he'd been in there for 8.5 years or thereabouts. Because going back to the front cover of the Herald Sun a few weeks ago, it was looking at the electorate of Werribee, and it showed that the One Nation vote there was quite high, obviously some sort of protest maybe against this youth justice facility. But there's obviously a bit of concern that One Nation could be taking votes from the Liberals, and it's not just a phenomena in WA and Queensland, it could also affect Victoria.
Well, I think that's true. I think the electorate's almost political weary at the moment in relation to whether it's federal or state politics, and we need to be careful that minor parties like One Nation don't sort of hit the cause button amongst the electorate, and we're very mindful of that. But there's no doubt Andrews government's very much on the nose in Victoria, not with just youth justice, but also with law and order. Certainly the allegations against the Speaker and Deputy Speaker in relation to rorting, and I think people have had enough. And I think they're looking to a coalition government, a Matthew Guy government in 2018, and the polling would indicate that at the moment.
Well, the poll that I think you're referring to was the front cover of the Herald Sun during the week, and it was quite a big poll in favour of the opposition, which is really the first time that we've seen a result like that in Victoria in terms of the polling since Daniel Andrews took office. But it was a reach-tell poll, and I know a lot of politicians tend to favour news poll and that reach-tell doesn't get a lot of credibility. So do you think that poll was accurate, saying that you had something like 54% of the two-party preferred vote?
Well, I'm certainly hearing in Western Victoria region, the region of which I represent, there's a groundswell against a number of policies that the Andrews government's pursuing, whether it's in relation to dealing with youth offenders or the youth justice system, or proposing a youth jail in Werribee South without consulting the community. There's the battle ongoing between the UFU and the CFA and our CFA volunteers, and I was down at the Bellarine Agricultural Show yesterday and met up with the Port Arlington Fire Brigade. I mean, they're very concerned about what's happening in relation to fire services generally, and the push by the Andrews government to split the fire service between career and volunteer. But there's also issues around the rorting, which I think the public have had enough of, and they want to see some action in relation to members of Parliament being held account in relation to the use of taxpayer dollars in relation to entitlement. So there's a lot of issues on the plate at the moment the electorate is very concerned about. energy costs. Obviously, the cost of energy and the push towards renewables at any cost is having an impact on cost of living and livability, and also population growth, which we as a coalition are trying to address through our population task force that's being implemented across regional Victoria and also into metro areas to deal with. How do we deal with the 100,000 new people coming into Victoria each year, of which 92% want to live in Melbourne? It's just stretching the infrastructure, the transport and the livability of our current suburbs.
Well, on your point about the rorting, of course, affecting the former Deputy Speaker and Speaker, and there's still a few issues there, like, for example, with the member for Melton at this stage, from what I understand, refusing to pay back money and wants to sit on the crossbench as an independent rather than resigning from Parliament, as now Labor MPs, including Anthony Carbines, are calling for. But do you think the fault lies with the actual voters in those electorates of Melton and Altona for electing people that fundamentally live outside the electorate? I mean, I've always said you get the politicians that you deserve, and if they've voted to support these people, if they turn out to be people that aren't necessarily good representatives just because they live so far from their electorate, doesn't that say more about the voters themselves?
Well, it does in part. I'm not sure the voters actually understood that Don Nardella was living in Ballarat and living in Ocean Grove in a caravan and living everywhere else, but his electorate of Melton, I'm not sure that they knew that. They probably wouldn't vote him in, as they have done for a number of years, 20-odd years. In fact, we've put many good candidates up to contest the electorate of Melton, but the voters continue to vote Labor in and vote Don Nardella in. So in part, that's right, you get what you vote for, but to be fair to the voters of Melton, I'm not sure if they understood that, in fact, their Member of Parliament wasn't living in the electorate, in fact, was rorting the second accommodation allowance, in that he was living in Ocean Grove, allegedly, in a caravan, or perhaps Ballarat, or anywhere else but Melton.
Do you have to actually live in the electorate to be a good representative? Because from what I understand, there's four Liberal or four opposition members that live outside their electorates.
Well, of course, there's boundary changes with divisional change in relation to quota of population as against electorate. So they will shift, and obviously some members will previously have lived in the electorate, but because of the VEC changes in boundary will find themselves out. So to be fair, you know, to uplift a family home and family is difficult. But those that purposely don't live in the electorate, not because of divisional changes, but on choice, I believe should be directed back into the electorate that they represent, because it's very important as a Member of Parliament to be local, to listen to what locals are saying to you, to be seen and engaging in your local electorate, and certainly Western Victoria region, which I represent, 75,000 square kilometres, so obviously very difficult to cover all of that. But the lower house electorates, I believe, the local members of parliament should live in their electorates.
Now, on the issue of penalty rates, this is a federal government issue, clearly, but Daniel Andrews has really inserted himself into this debate, coming out against some of the proposed changes to penalty rates as ruled by the Fair Work Commission. So even though the Fair Work Commission is an independent process, do you support their findings that penalty rates should be reduced on a Sunday to be more commensurate with Saturday pay?
Well, I'm not sure Daniel Andrews has actually read the full list of recommendations by the Fair Work Commission in relation to penalty rates. Certainly small business has been saying to us that the cost, particularly of public holidays, where it's 2.5 times more in wage than the Saturday rate, is crippling the small businesses to make even a profit on those public holiday days. In fact, many choose not to open, therefore, so there's a loss of job opportunity for those businesses who don't open because of those high penalty rates. But as I understand it, workers like in McDonald's or some of those franchises are covered by EBAs. So they're not affected by the Fair Work Commission recommendation, nor are casuals. It's only part-time or full-time workers that are not in current EBA contracts that will be affected. And they'll only be affected as much as they'll be paid the Saturday rate, which is double time and a quarter, as against the Sunday rate, which is double time and a half, as against the public holiday, which is higher. So we're not talking about a significant reduction in wage in relation to a reduction in penalty rates. But what it does mean is that at least those small businesses do have some opportunity to at least open on those public holidays and Sundays to be able to trade without the cost impact of those significantly high wages, which is forcing them to close their businesses.
So in summary, you think it's been overall a good decision from the Fair Work Commission?
Well, I think it's good to have a rational debate, but unfortunately we're not going to have a rational debate because the unions and Labor will try and create this perception that it's a significant drop in wages for those that can least afford. But I'm saying at least with some reduction in costs of labour to the public holidays and Sundays, particularly where traders are willing to open, it does allow job opportunities for our young that are unemployed or unable to get other jobs to be able to work on those days but still receive a fair wage, which is double time and a quarter to normal weekday rates. And to me, you know, that would seem to be a better system, a better option for job seekers than not being able to access a job at all because the business is not open.
And just on this point, I saw Stephen Conroy on Sky News during the week making some commentary in relation to the Kroger versus Reith situation in the Liberal Party, obviously for the Liberal Party president. And various MPs have come out pinning their colours to one side or the other, which I think has been interesting. But one of the things he said was that Peter Reith was in favour of cutting penalty rates and in favour of fracking. And he said Matthew Guy supporting Peter Reith was the best gift that could have been given to Victorian Labor. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm not sure Peter Reith is supportive of fracking. What he's supportive of is conventional onshore gas, and we've already heard this week about the debate about the shortage of gas supplies right across Australia, and certainly I do support allowing the science and the technical work to be done to allow, if safe, conventional onshore gas, which provides us with energy security when we need it the most. And that was what Peter Reith's point was, is, you know, with a reduction in offshore drilling and gas extraction, there will be a requirement to have some onshore, and we just need to work a way through how to do that safely. And that's why we supported the ban on fracking, but also supported allowing some flexibility in the moratorium of onshore gas to 2020. But in relation to Michael Kroger, the current president, and the election process the Liberal Party will go through on April 1 in relation to state council elections, that's a matter for the members, and I certainly encourage all members to get involved in that process as their democratic right. But I will tell you, Mitch, I am 100% supportive of Matthew Guy, our current leader, and his will and purpose, like all the parliamentary team, to win in 2018 the state election for the coalition.
So you won't be following some of the other MPs that have come out and made public statements you think it's best addressed behind closed doors?
Well, my vote will be private, and I'll vote for the person that I believe will support Matthew Guy and the Liberal Party to success for the election 2018.
Now, on the issue of Uber and the deregulation of the taxi industry, I was watching a little bit of this debate in the Legislative Assembly during the week, and it was interesting to see a lot of people in the public gallery were there, you know, representing the taxi industry. What do you think about this whole debate, which is currently underway as we speak, and we're about to speak to someone from the Victorian Hire Car Association?
Well, I believe the licensees of the taxi industry deserve fair compensation, and I believe the $2 tax as proposed by the Andrews government, and which we'll debate in the upper house in the next sitting week, is grossly unfair. I mean, a lot of these taxi services, particularly in regional Victoria, don't have Uber, and those that use the share riding facilities don't have options. They have a taxi service, a small business that has usually multiple licences that have paid up to $100 million for each licence in a regulated market, are suddenly finding their assets being reduced to about $100,000, and then the government's asking them to put in their pricing a $2 tax to revert back to the government in relation to any compensation package that the government's considering. And it's unfair, given some rides are $8 or less, to whack on a $2 charge and $4 if it's a, you know, return journey to many who can ill afford is grossly unfair, both also to the customer but also to the taxi service or the small businesses providing the taxi service themselves.
Very quickly, if we're not going to levy that $2 charge, where should the compensation funding come from?
Well, I think the government wants to deregulate. They want to allow competition in the marketplace, whereas Uber or some other ride-sharing business has a responsibility to make sure the assets in a regulated market of those small businesses, we're talking taxis at the moment, taxi license holders, should be fairly and equally compensated for. And the government seems to enjoy throwing billions of dollars away in relation to East West Link and other projects that haven't seen the light of day. I'm sure consolidated revenue will provide a means to provide fair compensation without putting on a $2 tax for a single journey for those, as I said, for those, particularly those disabled or those that are on pensions or can ill afford public transport or don't have the opportunity for public transport in many cases, to be charged almost a 30% tax for the government.
Simon, we have to leave it there, I'm sorry. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thanks, Simon Ramsey, their time for the news.
Mitchell's Front Page with Mitchell Dye. Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11 on 94.7 The Pulse.